Welcome to the View My Seats podcast for Monday, July 28th. I'm your host, John Lord. With me today from CBS Sports and Sports on Earth, college basketball insider Matt Norlander. Okay, Matt, before we get into the hoops, enlighten us for a second. Top five Pearl Jam songs of all time.
Oh, boy. First of all, thanks for having me on. I love doing podcasts like this where we can come in fresh, and I had no idea you were going to ask me that question. No Way is my favorite. That's off of Yield. That's my favorite one of all time. I would say this is Once and Porch are probably in my top five. Both those are off 10. I would say Rearview Mirror is probably in there, and Dirty Frank, which was actually never on an official album, but it's on the B-Cuts and Rarities compilation Lost Dogs. That's probably my top five. I might swap out Once with Corduroy, though, which is a fan favorite off of Vitalogy. Do you have a top five that you'd like to share, John?
You know, I don't, and it's kind of an evolving list, because I would say I am not as deep dive with Pearl Jam as you clearly are. You went straight up B-side on us right there, Matt.
I mean,
I'm pretty much, if it's not playing on the radio, if it's not from Vitalogy and some of the other big CDs, then I'm hard pressed to come up with a legitimate top five of real insider faves. Although I will say that when they play live, Rearview Mirror is about as good as it gets. And I would add, as far as the live experience goes, State of Love and Trust. Those two songs for me are about as good as it gets live.
Yes.
But you would know better than I would.
Well, actually, I wouldn't, because one of my biggest regrets is I still have never seen Pearl Jam in concert. It's not by choice. It's a tremendously unlucky thing that legitimately, so, you know, we both live here in Connecticut, and every time they've played in Connecticut, or I guess at the Garden in the city, I have legitimately had life interfere with my ability to see them. So it is cruel. I will amend that one day soon, I hope. But I do have plenty of live records, and you are on the money with State of Love and Trust. That would probably crack my top 15, but that's certainly a big time live staple.
Yeah, I've actually been somewhat fortunate to see Pearl Jam live a handful of times when they've come through the New York City metro area, and I have to say, and we'll keep this brief because we're about to lose everyone who's not between the ages of 30 and 45. They, as far as live performances go, they know how to put on a concert, and hopefully in the near future you get yourself a chance to get to one of their concerts. But the real reason we're here today is to not talk about Pearl Jam. It's to talk about a little college hoops. And thinking about college hoops here, you cover college basketball, but using your kind of understanding of college basketball, this summer you also did a little writing on the World Cup, as a lot of writers did. You know, a lot of us were thinking about how great the World Cup was and what an experience it was to watch the World Cup. So you wrote a little bit about the World Cup. So my first question for you, as a fan of the World Cup and also a college basketball insider, is which is the more corrupt organization, FIFA or the NCAA?
I think it is FIFA by a country mile. Now, I enjoyed the World Cup. I actually, you know, embraced soccer more this year than I ever had, in a way that the country did in such a huge way. The point I'm making here is I have a lot of friends who have followed soccer, both, you know, locally and internationally with FIFA. And this was actually discussed with a couple of buddies of mine. And FIFA is legendary for how corrupt it is. And even, like, it's kind of an open dialogue with the fact that Qatar got the 2022 Cup. That still might be revoked. It seems kind of in limbo right now, if they're even going to continue to be able to host it there. So I would say it is FIFA by a mile. I mean, there have been plenty of exposed bribes, issues over the years. The NCAA, for all of its issues, I would say is not nearly as corrupt, but certainly is far from a pristine model of how you want to run an organization. And the two biggest differences, I think, between them is whereas soccer is really benefited by having an overall governing body to help things like the World Cup happen. It's something of an essential thing if you want that. The NCAA's issue is that it deals with amateurism, and the definitions of that have consistently been questioned and altered over the decades that the NCAA has existed. So inherently, there are going to forever be problems with how the NCAA wants to operate versus or against, you know, what's pragmatic and right for young athletes. So I think that's why both are so easily comparable, because they're constantly controversial. But I think in terms of pure corruptness, it doesn't beat FIFA.
That's too bad. You didn't take the bait. I was really hoping you were going to take the NCAA. You established why the two are different. But I think many people look at them similarly, as you mentioned. And in the case of the NCAA, I think American sports fans are much more familiar with the plight of the NCAA than we were FIFA. But certainly this summer, I think mainstream sports fans in this country were kind of enlightened to what FIFA has been up to for so long. And it, to many people, it kind of just started to make this comparison. Boy, FIFA and the NCAA sure do sound very similar. But regarding the NCAA, my question about the NCAA is first of all, what is their original charter? What reason do they have to exist? And also, what's stopping super conferences like the SEC and the Big Ten and the Pac-10 and the Big 12 from just breaking free from the NCAA model and starting their own thing?
Well, I'll go first question first. Why does the NCAA exist? I think when it started more than 70 years ago, it had a legitimate reason to exist because, I mean, the very infrastructure of the American sports scene and just telecommunications and organization was just obviously so drastically different than it is today. And it's been just kind of something that's consistently grown and been there because it has good purposes. Don't get me wrong. I mean, why does the NCAA exist? Well, you know, on the level of, you know, female soccer and men's lacrosse and swimming and all these other smaller sports, the NCAA does a great service for them in terms of organizing championships and benefiting them with competitions and easing some financial concerns, or at least, you know, hosting abilities that otherwise might be somewhat difficult. You know, football and men's basketball don't really need the NCAA in any sort of way, but it primarily exists to help those smaller sports. And there are plenty of reasons that it still exists to, you know, to benefit some powers that be that make a little too much money for what they do. And, you know, I think in the past half decade, the criticisms and awareness of the American public regarding the NCAA have become more and more prominent. And so with that, the NCAA has lost, you know, its standing, its Q rating, some of its power. And why, you know, doesn't the SEC, Big 12, Pac-12, and all those conferences, why don't they separate? Well, they very well could, because at least in football, here's what I think is going to happen. I actually did talk to a number of college basketball coaches over the past couple of weeks while on the recruiting trail, and I did ask them I said, in 10 years, do you think, you know, in college basketball, Kentucky will still play in the same division as a Belmont? Some said yes. Right. Some said yes. Some said no. Here's the ongoing theory: is that football will separate itself, and you'll have all the schools from the big conferences that could be, you know, 70 to 80 schools tops. Those schools will separate, will remove themselves entirely from the NCAA's governing structure, because the reason they can do that is all of the bowl games, they're not run by the NCAA, but the NCAA men's basketball tournament is run and organized, and I will say, for the most part, pretty terrifically by the NCAA. It's by far the best aspect to the organization, is they actually handle that tournament, for the most part, with aplomb. They do a good job. They have for so many years, and a lot of that was because of a man named Greg Shaheen, who was in charge of running it for about 12 years and made it as good as it's ever been. I do think that's why we will still have a Division I college basketball structure with more than 300 teams, which in my opinion is way too many. I think D1 should be 180 to 200 teams tops, but you know what, that's a whole separate issue. But 10 years from now, I still think we're going to have a 68-team tournament with D1 teams. But I think college football, Auburn, Alabama, UCLA, USC, Florida, Virginia Tech, those bigger schools, I think they're going to be on their own thing. They're going to be in a separate kind of division. I don't know what it's going to be called. I don't know who is going to govern it. But I think we are headed toward that, because the simple matter is the money and resources that Alabama can operate at are just so different from Georgia State. You've got plenty of schools that play D1 hoops that don't even have a football program. So a splintering is coming. I just think it's going to be another 5 or 6 or 7 years before that happens.
Right. All the financial incentive and the financial power rests with these individual schools in the super conferences. And so maybe there does come a time in the not so distant future when they are emboldened by just the sheer amount of money that they make. And I don't know how super conference schools look at it, but do they see the NCAA as the reason why they're making so much money, or is the reason they're making so much money is because of the product they put on the field?
Yeah, I don't think I don't think in most cases the athletic directors and the presidents at these schools think that the NCAA is necessarily helping them at this point. That might have been the case in the 70s, maybe into the early 80s, but you know, football long ago, the powers that be in that sport at the D1 level and the major D1 level realized that the NCAA was hindering more than helping. They're able to earn these profits and profit share within their leagues based on the fact that, you know, football has been king in this country for 20 years and has only enhanced in popularity over the past decade. Where it goes going forward, I think, is actually an interesting side discussion in that concerns over concussions, lawsuits that have happened, that could happen again. Will that impact football's popularity, its participation level? I don't know. I think football is at a peak right now in the past 5 years in this country that it might not be able to equal going forward, but that does not mean that these power conference schools are still not going to be able to create enough revenue and money that make it, you know, a valid option to separate themselves from the NCAA and the governing structure. I think that process is just a little more tedious than I think a lot of people might realize when they talk about it happening. So I do think it's going to happen, but we haven't quite approached the point where it's, okay, a legitimate possibility, this is happening soon. And then once that decision is made, I think that process will still take, you know, 4, 5, 6 years to happen.
And what I fear is if you do separate the super conference schools from the NCAA and you have them creating their own thing, you know, for years now, they've driven the decision making process in many cases for the NCAA. So if you remove that pool from the NCAA, you alluded to the smaller schools, the Belmonts, the Georgia States. You know, I'm a small school guy. We all are in the Northeast. I worry about intercollegiate athletics in smaller schools. If you take these super conference schools out of the NCAA, do you have the NCAA that loses much of its luster, much of its financial muscle? And what are they then able to do for the smaller schools that still rely on its organizational help?
I think that's accurate. I think the only thing that would be able to save it is if, you know, all 351 D1 basketball, men's basketball schools still can be eligible and play in the NCAA tournament, because you know, the parent company I work for, CBS, along with Turner, are paying billions to broadcast this tournament, which ratings-wise has been improving again. I mean, it really hit a nice peak in the 80s and 90s, and then for a 7 or 8 year period, it plateaued and dipped a little bit. But over the past 3 or 4 years, with the games being on TBS, TNT, CBS, and True TV, the ratings have jumped up, ad dollars have gone up. That, you know, that helps CBS to be able to afford to pay the NCAA all this money. And all that money, it pools out, yes, to the schools that get into the tournament, but also to conferences. That's a very complicated thing in terms of what they call units and how teams and leagues make money based off of appearances. But the point is, there's a serious trickle-down effect, and nothing is a revenue driver the way that men's basketball tournament is in the NCAA tournament. So I think as long as that marriage stays, and I do think that it will, and I hope it will. And I'll also add, John, that, you know, I have spoken to plenty of coaches at bigger schools about this, you know, recently and over the past year or two. And for the most part, they very much like the fact that you've got small schools that are those 14, 15, 16 seeds. You know, it's a pain if you've got to be upset by them, but they also understand that it's actually good for the game, for the tournament, for the sport, that you've got this dichotomy there. And they want a little of both. I mean, they want that, but at the same time, they know that they've got serious, serious advantages in so many ways. If you're at Michigan State or Kentucky or Florida, you name any sort of big-time school, there's just, I mean, it's just incredible, the resources and the money that they have over a Morehead State or a small school like that. But I don't think hardly any coaches, at least, and I think plenty of ADs at these big schools, from a basketball standpoint, I don't think they want to splinter off and entirely separate themselves from Ohio Valley and Southland Conference of schools.
Well, I think another reason why a lot of people in this country, and we're talking with Matt Norlander, college basketball insider from CBS Sports and Sports on Earth, I think another reason why a lot of people do group FIFA and the NCAA together is obviously because of the money that changes hands here with both organizations. And in the case of the NCAA, you mentioned the nature of amateurism and how we are really probably on the verge of things changing moving forward as far as the O'Bannon lawsuit and then the Northwestern decision to unionize. And there are going to be more issues certainly that come up in the near future. How do you see these court cases, these momentous decisions, how do you see these things affecting the nature of the NCAA in the future?
Fairly greatly. And for those listening, there, you're probably well aware of the things that John's referencing here. But specifically, the Northwestern unionization case, we'll see how that shakes out. But overall, I mean, if you're able to basically get a judge to rule that college players can unionize, that means they are employees. It creates issues for the NCAA, for the schools, for the players themselves. I mean, if, you know, at that point, you're going to be able to ask for certain rights, but then you're going to be treated like a professional in a lot of ways. And that, you know, on a case-by-case basis can backfire for some players in some ways and maybe won't in other ways. The bigger one, though, is the NCAA.
Well, though, sorry to interrupt, but one of the reasons why that can backfire for the players is because all of a sudden those $60,000 to $70,000 scholarships become taxable.
Correct. That is by far the biggest factor here. That once you can tax, let's also make note the fact that the NCAA is not taxed on anything right now either. And so that is a huge reason why it can operate the way it operates. So once you bring taxes into effect, I think that complicates it for a lot of people. And certainly, I mean, right now, 14 to 15 year olds that are on pace to become D1 athletes have zero idea about all this. So it's an interesting can of worms to open. The NCAA versus Ed O'Bannon case, which is still ongoing, and basically is arguing that players deserve to be paid for any sort of likeness that the NCAA is used to profit off of their image. It's one that is hard to argue against. A lot of people believe the NCAA is going to lose this case, and because of that, it's actually going to have to back pay a lot of people for having made money off of players in the past. But basically, going forward, and this I have no issue with, if a player can earn money off of his likeness at 19, 20 years old, the NCAA wants to fight that because it's against their ideal of amateurism. But basically, if it's an open market, and we're not talking salaries, we're talking basic stuff, whether it could be something like a local car dealership wanting to use your face to help sell a car. I know that sounds weird to a lot of people, and it might, you know, open up this weird avenue where, okay, if you're using their face to sell a car, what's to stop that car dealer from giving a certain athlete a car? Well, you know what? It just might happen, and then you got to deal with the consequences.
It certainly hasn't stopped them in the past.
It hasn't stopped them in the past. No, absolutely. So there, in my opinion, though, the NCAA is going to pay millions upon millions of dollars when this case ends and is settled, because they have not settled. They've had plenty of chances to settle the case, but the lawyers have steadfastly believed that they are going to win it, and they might well still. That would be a huge headline if they did, but judging off the reporting and listening to plenty of legal experts that have been tracking this, it doesn't seem like the NCAA is on pace to win based off of its defense of what amateurism is and what, you know, 19, 20-year-old students that happen to play sports in college are owed or have a right to. When it ends, though, I think what the NCAA is will be very different. And the thing that's going to happen no matter what is there's this thing called a cost of attendance scholarship. It's basically anywhere between $2,000 and $5,000 of extra money, basically cash in hand for players to get, depending on the school that they go to. It's the NCAA's way of bargaining with the fact that it knows that students aren't really truly getting enough for what their value is and what their worth is, considering how much money they bring in. That will happen. It was voted in to happen previously 2 years ago, but actually the small schools could not quite afford it at that time, so enough of them voted against it that when after it initially passed, it had to make, you know, clear one more bar, and it did not clear that bar. I think it is going to become a rule where schools will then have the say. So if you're a small school and you can only afford $500 to $1,000 for cost of attendance, but you're Alabama and you can afford $5,000, that's going to be part of the deal going forward.
It only seems logical to me that these players are allowed to make money while attending college, regardless of their scholarship status. And you kind of alluded to this. It makes too much sense to me, at least, to not allow players who generate revenue for a school to be able to benefit from some of that revenue. And you take the case of, say, like a Johnny Manziel. Johnny Manziel made so much money for Texas A&M. And for Johnny Manziel to not profit from the amount of money that he made for Texas A&M seems a little foolish. So why not just do something as simple as establish trusts that players cannot touch until they are done with their college careers? And in those trusts are a portion of the revenue that the player has made for the school while that player was at the school. You know, you look at Johnny Manziel and the number of jerseys that he sold for Texas A&M. Shouldn't he be getting a portion of those jersey sales that, okay, he can't touch while he's in school, but when he leaves school, when his amateur status is gone, when he's living in Cleveland, he should be allowed to touch those profits that he made for the school. It just sounds too logical to not happen. And I'll tell you something else. If you're the NCAA and you see other large corporations like EA Sports settling, you know, in the case of the O'Bannon lawsuit, which they did, right? EA
yes,
Sports.
They did. They settled about halfway through, and that was kind of a big signal toward this not going the way of the NCAA side in the big case.
Right. So now the NCAA is kind of the lone defendant here. And one of the reasons I've got to imagine that the NCAA is really, really resisting any kind of settlement is because if the status of college athletes changes and you can start to pay student athletes for their play, for their participation, just the logistics, just the scaffolding that's going to go into the NCAA trying to figure out the slots for different athletes and different sports and what each athlete gets paid, because it's not just going to be the football and the basketball players that are going to get paid, even though those are the only revenue producing sports at these schools. If the NCAA is still this blanket organization over all these different sports, they're going to have to play the soccer players, the swimmers, the crew, you name it. How they figure out a way to pay all these different athletes at these different levels is going to be just a bureaucratic nightmare.
It will absolutely become that. And the other problem is, you know, these conferences on the whole are making money, but a lot of that is driven by football. So unless you're in a big time conference that has football, you actually aren't really producing revenue. And so how are you going to be able, like, Ohio State has no problem paying, like, doing that because of amount of money they make. You know, Florida is the same way. You pick any sort of big school. But, for example, trying to think of, like, a decent college basketball school without a football team. Like, okay, so Gonzaga.
Take a Davidson, a Gonzaga.
Davidson specifically.
A Butler.
Yes. They are not, at the end of the fiscal year, their books are not in the black when it comes to profits. So where is that money going to come from? Is it going to be supplied somehow by the conferences overall, by the NCAA? Which is why when you have these kind of logistic issues here, it's why I've always been really supportive of the Olympic model, which is basically if you want to earn money outside of, you know, if for some reason schools wind up only being able to give stipends for $500 or $2,000, that's fine. But personally, I've got zero issue if Subway wants to sponsor someone that gets as good as Steph Curry was at Davidson. If he's that good and you want corporate sponsorship, I have no problem with it whatsoever. Shouldn't jeopardize any sort of amateur, quote-unquote, status that the NCAA sees. It's just something that they've continually resisted. And it's bizarre because there, I mean, these issues are very complex, and there's a lot of stuff that that seems counterintuitive to each other. Like, for example, there's a player at Notre Dame right now who's going to be a senior. I think it's Garrick Sherman or Pat Connaughton, sorry. He got drafted to play in the major leagues, baseball. He's a pitcher. And just talking to his coach, Mike Bray, a couple of days ago out in Las Vegas, who was on the recruiting trail, and he got paid like $240,000 for 6 weeks of, work in the minor leagues under the Reds, I think, drafted him. Totally acceptable under the NCAA guidelines because baseball is considered his secondary sport. And so he's going to play. He's got one more year of college basketball. He will go back and play despite the fact that he's got all this money. Well, if that kind of thing is okay, then what is the difference between that and earning a sponsorship from some sort of corporation outside of your sport? To me, they're basically the same thing.
Well, because the NCAA would say that the reason that sponsorship exists is as a byproduct of their first job, which is playing the sport. But I'll tell you that, if you and I can figure out a way to make $240,000 in our secondary jobs, I think we'd look for those types of employment opportunities. You wrote today on CBS Sports about how scholarships, a lot of coaches nowadays are reserving scholarships for transfers in college basketball.
Yeah.
And this is something that I had never thought of before. And as I was reading your piece on CBS Sports today, I couldn't help but think that saving spots for transfers may only add to the, I don't know if corruption is the right word, but certainly the confusion as far as, do we know what players are going to be available? Do we know how many spots we're going to need for the next year? And I know coaches are still kind of getting used to this model. And from your piece, it looks like some coaches are more in favor of the model than others. Do you see this whole transfer becoming more popular as recruits? Do you see this adding to the potential, I don't know if corruption is the right word, but potential issues with NCAA basketball?
Maybe. This is a...
Won't there be... I don't know how this works. You know better than I do. But if you are saving spots for transfers, can't that only add to a coach's perhaps inadvertent desire and willingness to recruit players on other teams?
That is... a logical assumption to make, but basically, all right, here's how it works. So right now there are teams out there recruiting players, right? High school players, and they're trying to fill spots for high school players that will graduate next spring. So they're 2015 players is what they're referred to as. And let's say a coach has three spots open for 2015. Well, basically what they're doing now is the reason why I don't think what will happen, what you're referring to, is it is a lock that there are going to be players for them to pick up on the transfer market because there are so many. I mean, more than 600 this year. There'll probably be more than 700 next year. The reasons for that are a different issue altogether. But they would rather take a guy who knows what it's like to attend a college campus, to be a college basketball player, for good or for bad, experiences that they have. Sometimes they leave because of a coaching change. A lot of times when players are leaving, it's not necessarily for a bad reason. So, sometimes it is, but a lot of times it's not. I'd say in 75% of cases when a player is transferring, it's really for a legitimate reason and doesn't really have a lot of negative connotations to it. There are some.
Yeah, my favorite part of your piece was how there used to be this stigma attached to the transfer, and that they were soft, that they were considered, that they were bad for team chemistry. But that stigma doesn't exist anymore, is what you're saying.
Doesn't. Now, there still are guys that they can't be appeased, and it just doesn't work. That does exist, but it's not the majority. And so what's happening here is coaches are saying, okay, unless we can get, like, every team has a target of recruits. Okay, this is our number one guy we're going after, 2, 3, 4, 5. And if they can't get you know, if they're looking for three guys and they can't get those three guys in their top five or so, they're saying, we'd rather have someone that's older, that really just understands what college is about. They come in, their disillusionments of how much playing time they're going to get, all this stuff, that's really shed, it shed away a lot of it. So when they come to the program, they're older, they're more mature, they're less likely to transfer again. It does happen where you'll have a guy leave from two schools, but that does not happen too often. So there is a little bit of a security factor there as well. So for the most part, I don't see a lot of corruption in terms of trying to recruit players on other teams to come to your team. Does it happen? It does. It definitely does. There are cases where coaches will use back avenues to get a temperature reading on a guy, or maybe in some cases really instigate a guy, you know, as quietly as they possibly can to say, you know what, your situation at this school, it could be so much better if you came to us. That does happen. I don't think it's tremendously common. And so overall, I think this is actually a fairly good thing for the sport, because it puts less stress on coaches in terms of recruiting. Transfers in general are seen as a benefit to teams because of the mere nature of what I talked about and what they're coming in, how they're older. And if you've got a team of older players, generally speaking, that's going to be a better team overall.
You this summer you also covered the NBA draft, and certainly there are a lot of franchise changing players that were drafted top of the first round, and I wonder what you thought about trading Wiggins for a guy like Kevin Love. If you were running the Cleveland Cavaliers front office right now, Matt,
yeah,
would you make the Andrew Wiggins for Kevin Love trade straight up?
I think I would. I mean, there are factors that would go into that in terms of what Cleveland would have to give up, like a future first rounder. It might be Wiggins, Anthony Bennett, someone else for Love. I think I'd make it because I was talking with a couple of writers about this 2 weeks ago or a week and a half ago, whenever we were mulling it over. And really, we couldn't get past like six or seven players in the NBA we'd rather have over Love. I mean, it was a really short list. And then we kind of did the same with Wiggins. And since there are so many unknowns, I mean, you can get to about 23 or 24 players before you're kind of like, no, I'd rather take Wiggins over him. So when you take that into consideration, and you know that LeBron James has four or five more peak years, tops left, that championship would mean so much to Cleveland. I think that you have to make that deal. Now, obviously, Wiggins just signed a few days ago, and it's a good NBA rule because it kind of avoids any sort of immediate collusion, but he cannot be traded for 30 days after he's been signed. So if this is going to happen, we're not going to know until late August. I think they should do it. I will add a caveat to this, though. I think it is interesting that's taken this long for it to happen, and I don't think it's only because of Wiggins' potential. I'm not an NBA insider by any means, but I happen to know a couple of guys who know the league decently well and have some connections there. And Love is a coveted player, but I don't think he is an outstanding and a stellar teammate. I'm not saying he's a bad teammate. I'm just saying he's not a dream teammate overall. Puts up great numbers, and isn't a tremendous defender. So I think there might be just a little bit of hesitation there on if he comes in, what kind of contract is he going to bring and how is he going to gel? I think that's just been a little bit of an understated factor in this. Ultimately, I think they will deal for Love. But that's just my guess. I would think that's going to happen. If it doesn't happen, it's going to be fun seeing Wiggins and LeBron play together with Kyrie Irving, who really could take a big step as a point guard as well. I mean, he's kind of a combo shooting point guard. I think with LeBron there, hopefully Kyrie will morph a little bit more into a true point guard. If they have that, they're going to be fun either way. But if I was the GM, I'd go get Love and try and win, you know, two or three titles in the next 4 or 5 years.
But my understanding, and I think I was reading something from might have been Grantland last month, but I think I was reading something about how the Cavs don't necessarily have to act now in the sense that they can kind of play this out for a little while and see how LeBron and Wiggins and Irving kind of mesh together to see, you know, what kind of gaps they still have in their roster before deciding to deal Kevin Love. And then from Kevin Love's perspective, you know, if he's not guaranteed, I guess when LeBron and his team negotiated with Cleveland, they negotiated a 2-year contract, and that was just because there's going to be changes to the salary cap. And my understanding is that he's going to be in Cleveland longer than 2 years. But if you're Kevin Love, it's kind of got to make you a little nervous to say, hey, yeah, I'm with the Cavs for the future. And let's say you sign a deal or sign and trade where you sign him with the Cavs long term, and LeBron bolts in 2 years. I mean, yeah, that's kind of, that's probably something that a guy like Kevin Love would look to avoid. Okay, this is really testing your knowledge here. If you can go back to the draft and tell us one player from the second round.
Okay.
One player from the second round who NBA fans should be aware of / is going to have an immediate impact on a contending team.
Ooh, would we define a contending team as a team that has a good shot to make the conference finals? Is that how we want to say contending team?
Yes, that would be considered.
That is a tough one. Okay, this isn't my answer, but if I was cheating, it would be Kyle Anderson, who went to the Spurs. He was the very last pick of the first round, point guard from UCLA. He could not have landed in a better spot.
You're also just saying that because it's the Spurs.
Yeah, well, I know, but it's like
they don't make mistakes.
It's unreal that they got him. Okay, 6'9" point guard, point forward, whatever you want to call it. Like, he's got this like Euro style game. It is just ridiculous that he went there, and not a shock that the Spurs got him. A player that would qualify, except that he doesn't play for a contender, Cle'Anthony Early, who went to the Knicks.
Yes. I was hoping you were going to say that. I shouldn't have said contending.
It's okay, though. It's okay. But he is, in my opinion, really going to be one of the 15 best players from this draft in 5 years. I think he's got just tremendous ability, great acumen, plays both sides of the ball well, a better shooter than people give him credit for. I think he's solid. I did just bring up the Wikipedia page here. I'm looking to see.
But on Early, here's what this is what makes me scratch my head with some of these NBA guys is – that was such a no-brainer for the Knicks in that spot. And how does a guy like Cle'Anthony Early slide that low in the second round? Because if you're a basketball fan and you have watched any college basketball, you watch a guy like Cle'Anthony Early and you say, that guy can play at the next level.
Oh, yeah, clearly. I mean, he had a huge March, solid February. I don't have an answer for you on this because it's something I wonder about every year. There are just two or three guys in every draft that go way higher than I think they should and two or three that fall just too far to the floor. Sometimes it can be because – honestly, it's a fit, and there might be a string of four or five teams where it's a bad fit. It seems silly, but I think that happens. I also think that we don't get a lot of information on how these guys interview. At least publicly, that information isn't dispersed. And I'm not saying Cle'Anthony Early was a bad interview. He might not have been. He might have been a good one. But I think sometimes things like that can have an effect on where a player falls as well. So I think that's why overall. Man, the second round, by the way, in terms of teams that picked – This is pretty bad. It is a bad group. I'm sticking with Early because I mean, we got Minnesota, we got Charlotte. Jordan Clarkson of the Wizards I don't think is going to be that big of an impact. Cameron Bairstow, who had a great year at New Mexico, he went to the Bulls at 49, but I don't know how much of an impact Bairstow is going to have. So I think Early is actually the pick because I actually like him more than any other second round pick. And the Knicks, I mean, they've got a decent shot at making the playoffs. They're not going to be contending to get to the finals by any means. But if they had a good year, I could see them getting like a 7 seed, maybe a 6.
Okay, we'll let you go after this one right here, Matt. Okay, this is from your Twitter feed. It's easy to tell that you are an enormous Chicago Bears fan.
Yes,
and so I know it is certainly not your responsibility to cover the Bears for CBS or Sports on Earth, but I was wondering if you would just enlighten us for a few seconds on how the Chicago Bears are going to do in the upcoming NFL season.
Wow, a chance to talk Bears. This is a rare
it's your fault.
A rare offering here. I tell you, yeah, I'm a huge, huge Bears fan. I think I'm so unaccustomed to the team having so much offense. It's really been weird over the past 2 years to see them perform this well. But of course, all things must balance out in life, and so their defense was arguably as worse as it's ever been last year. I think they'll be solid. That division is going to be a lot of fun because Green Bay, who I hate with the fury of a thousand suns, they're going to be favored to win the division, and they probably could. My expectations, I always try and temper them. I'm 9-7 is my expectation. Minnesota will be a little down. I think Detroit's not going to be that good. So within the division, they're going to have a decent shot. It's just the NFC West is just so good. The South is solid. You know, you'll have the Saints, the Panthers. I know they don't have a wide receiving core, but they'll be decent this year. Overall, though, I think this is the year for the Bears that, I mean, Cutler's had some good years. I think Cutler's going to have a clear-cut Pro Bowl kind of season. And if Marshall and Alshon Jeffrey perform again like they did last year when they were the best receiving core in the league, I think they're just, the overall awareness, the press, people are going to start looking at the Bears as a viable contender in the NFC. It's just a matter of if their defense can even be half as better as it was last year, if that's a weird thing to say. They were just so putrid. I just never seen so many open gaps on defense the way that they were last year. If they can improve like that, they should be better. But 9-7 is my hope, and anything better than that I'll gladly take. It was rough. I mean, they, you know, two of the past three seasons of Chicago, they've basically been virtually a lock to make the playoffs, and then they've lost, you know, three of their final four of their final five to play themselves out of the bracket. So it's been a rough couple of years. Who, by the way, I'm putting you on the spot. Who is do you have an NFL team that you follow and would like to prognosticate on here?
I do, but people aren't going to like it. And the reason they are my NFL team, people are going to like even less. I am a New England Patriots fan, and the reason I'm a New England Patriots fan is not because I was born and raised in New England. It's because they started winning when I was in college.
Oh, that's pretty bad, actually.
It's actually incredibly pathetic. But I hope to get some sort of the public to equip me a little, because I'm very honest about it. I make no qualms about the fact that when the Patriots stop winning, I'll be a free agent once again. And hopefully the market does cater to me.
Wow, how about that? Okay, so yeah, you're totally open about
and the Bears, as far as your undying love for the Chicago Bears, I will say two things about the Chicago Bears. Number one, maybe you should have kept Brian Urlacher. And number two, if you wanted that defense to be better. And number two, the thing with Jay Cutler is that he is the most GIF, most Vine ready quarterback in the NFL.
That's unbelievable.
And there are just so many ways to waste a Sunday afternoon by looking at different Tumblr accounts dedicated to Jay Cutler. He is one of my favorite NBA NFL players, just simply because of the internet's undying love.
I know, and I'm telling you, though, whereas like 4 years ago, like everyone hated him, now it's almost like he's cheekily self-aware of the fact that how he looks and how he acts in this kind of weird way is actually getting people to embrace him. And part of that is because I think we understand him a little bit better and understand that he really just doesn't give an F. Okay. And so because of that, people are actually looking at him in a bit of a higher regard. And so I think that's why overall, if Chicago's relatively decent this year, and if Cutler kind of carries the team again, he'll become even more likable. And then, and however he embraces that should be interesting to see.
You know, everyone out there has Bill Murray stories, right? You know, Bill Murray just shows up at weddings, and he shows up. It seems like everybody in Chicago has a Jay Cutler story, and I have relatives who live in Chicago, and it seems like they all each have different Jay Cutler stories about Jay Cutler showed up at this bar, Jay Cutler showed up at this restaurant, Jay Cutler was in the bathroom, and I was in the bathroom, and they're all hilarious, funny stories. I don't even know if they're all true, but I can believe them because it's Jay Cutler, and because I have this idea in my head of who Jay Cutler is, that he has become this parody of himself that makes watching him now play for the Bears that much more entertaining. Well, Matt Norlander, CBS Sports, Sports on Earth, thanks for the time, and we look forward to talking to you again sometime soon.
John, it was a pleasure to come on and chat with you. Thanks so much for the time as well, and yeah, we'll talk on down the road.
I appreciate it, Matt.